Welcome to Stronger and Safer, the podcast produced by Building Hope Today. The mission of Building Hope Today is to prevent and reduce childhood sexual abuse. The concept and goal behind the Stronger and Safer podcast is to support this mission by educating and equipping justice professionals and multidisciplinary teams with principles and practices needed to support victims and survivors and hold offenders accountable. In addition, the Stronger and Safer podcast will provide tools, resources, and support for those that do the courageous work of advocating for, caring for, and supporting healing for victims and survivors. Finally, the Stronger and Safer podcast will provide a space to give victims and survivors an opportunity to give voice to their experiences. The Stronger and Safer podcast will include a variety of approaches for meeting the needs of justice professionals, advocates, communities, and victim survivors. The podcasts are broken into four separate tracks. Track one, Voices of Victims. Track two, Self-Care for criminal justice professionals, law enforcement, and victim advocates. Track three, Lessons from the Field. And track four, On Guard, Protecting Our Children. Welcome back to our listeners who have joined us for part two of the very first Voices of Victims podcast. We're going to continue talking with Anne Tierney today, and she has spent her entire career giving victims a voice. And so it's really a privilege to continue this conversation with you, Anne, that we started in the previous podcast. I think it's important to really talk about this whole concept of being trauma-informed or victim-centered. And sometimes those get to be buzzwords. And so I really thought that it would be good to start this this next conversation with you, really talking about what does that mean? To meet that advocacy need. Because I think that we fall pretty short there when we think about long-term support. And, you know, as we get into that, you know, and you said this, I think, when we talked last week, and I giggled because it's so true. We get our words and then we stick with them forever. So we've used this word trauma-informed and victim-centered mm-hmm. for how long? Mm-hmm. And it's so important, but I think that it means something so different, and it has to not just be words. There have to be actions that go with all of that. So in your work and in what you've seen, how important is it really to have those conversations around being victim-centered and trauma-informed with our professionals that are working with our survivors, and also with those that may be supporting people that want to share their stories later on in life? What does that really mean to be victim-centered? And you hit on probably the number one thing several times already, so I know what you're probably going to say. But also, what does it mean to be trauma-informed as we work with survivors who want to share their story, whether it be from the very beginning of disclosure all the way through maybe later in their life if they choose to want to write a book or become a speaker at a conference or share their story some other way?
Yeah, so I'll try to answer that. But if I leave something out, prompt me. You know, I think that when we talk about being victim-centered, we, like you said, we can talk about it all day long, but it has to be action-oriented. And so, you know, something that we strive to do is to speak to that child or to that teenager and try to give them some power that maybe they've lost through the process of, you know, going, you know, telling their initial disclosure or coming to the center or whatever that might be. But one of the simplest things is we give the child, even if it's a small child, we give them our business card and say, you know, this is how you can get a hold of me. Because sometimes that can matter so much that it's not just going to mom or dad or the non-offending caregiver that's there that day, but it's to them and letting them know that they can call you back. We can continue to talk about this if they've forgotten something or they want to come and meet, you know, with your colleague. But so, I mean, that's just a very simple, like, start doing that. If you're not, get on the child's level, and you, business cards don't matter. You have 8 million of them. So making sure that you're doing that is so important. But also, I mean, when we're talking about being victim-centered and sharing stories, I think it's so important to have a conversation with the family, or, you know, non-offending caregiver, whoever is around them, that this is that child or that adolescent or that person's story. This is not your story. You have your own story of what happened, yeah, and how it impacted you and what your thoughts and feelings were and maybe how it brought things up for you and your, you know, abuse. Because we see that a lot. I know you do too, where, you know, the child comes in, makes a disclosure and caregiver says, yes, this also happened to me. And then they're processing or their childhood trauma. And so I think really making that delineation for that non-offending caregiver of this is, or whoever the support is, this is, you know, this child, this adolescent, this adult story, it's not yours. And it's not yours to share without permission. Right. It's not yours to add to. Yeah. It's not yours to color in any way. And I think that that can be very frustrating. I know for parents when we're, you know, in counseling and we're only sharing certain pieces, you know, and they're saying, well, I'm paying for counseling, or, you know, the child's minor. And it's like, I understand that, but we're helping this person, you know, reclaim their power, reclaim their story, process. And so when we do have the parent and caregiver, you know, come in and things are shared, it's done in a very safe, very, timing is so important. And then we've talked about it and we've prepped the caregiver and we've prepped the child. And I mean, it's, so I think that it is a very strategic process, but it has to be one that's driven by the victim, by the survivor, and that someone else can't take that microphone or, you know, that, that pulpit and tell their story, because that can be so, so damaging. And right. I've seen it, where it tries to get colored in a different light, and that's not fair. Yeah. So I think it's important though to manage those expectations of parents and non-offending caregivers about what this process might look like and how they can be supportive, because ultimately they want to be supportive. But I know, and we've all seen when, you know, the parent or non-offending caregiver shares their child's story, how damaging that can be, because, you know, this wider group of family or friends, that can be so alienating for a child and teenager and person to hear that they've been, you know, their whole story has been told.
Yeah. Yeah. And then their story has to become the story that's through the lens of the person that is their caregiver. And then, you know, we work with so many people many years later that say, I don't even know what my story is anymore. Yeah. Is this my story, or is this something that somebody just told me what happened? Mm-hmm. And I think you hit the nail on the head when you say managing expectations, both for the survivor who is disclosing, but also working through the details and putting those puzzle pieces together, because it doesn't just happen usually in one conversation. But when you mentioned when oftentimes, you know, parent or whomever is the supportive person for the child comes in and all of a sudden they're sharing their story, for all kinds of reasons, I think that that's a really key point for us to be aware of, whether it be child advocacy centers or law enforcement or advocacy in general or whomever, that be prepared for that to happen. And when that happens, you don't want to just shut somebody down and say, this isn't your story, because we want that individual also to begin to get the help that they need so that they can be supportive for the victim. So who are your partnerships right away? And I know that you've mentioned a couple of things that you guys do in this, which is amazing. And I think we should do a whole podcast on it. But, you know, when that happens, what is that next step to be able to address that disclosure and that trauma in a way that doesn't let it take over what you're doing to support the current victim, but also is an immediate handoff? Now that caregiver or non-offending caregiver parent may not choose to to access what you've provided for them. But I think it's a huge part of creating that support network around that individual who is either disclosing for the first time or many years later sharing their story, you know. Your thoughts on that? I mean, you guys do a pretty good job with that. I think you've got a really good
We do. I mean, and like you said earlier, I mean, we can't work in silos. We have to work together. We have to leverage our team members. But we also have... we have hired mental health counselors, and we kind of play different roles. So we can rotate between who's going to be the forensic interviewer, who's going to be, you know, the family advocate that day, you know, who's kind of who's doing what. But we do have a background where if we have a parent who starts disclosing their story, we have some training to handle and to help that parent, you know, walk through those initial disclosures and kind of make a game plan without shutting them down. And that is separate from our larger team, with our law enforcement and our, you know, CPS worker, DCFS, whatever you call them in your state. But then we can come back together and then call like our county victim advocate or our DV center, you know, and get a bigger plan. But I think, you know, if you don't know how to respond to someone who's disclosing, seek out some training. I mean, there's amazing trainings available, because I do think that in that moment, you hold so much power. Whether you should or shouldn't, you hold so much power when someone is telling you, you know, about their abuse story. And what happens next is, colors so much moving forward. Right. And not only does it color in my scenario, at least at a child advocacy center, not only does it color this caregiver's, you know, next steps in their life and processing this, but it may color how they will allow their child to seek services,
right?
And their child to heal. And so I can't stress how important that is to have people who have some training and have some appropriate responses that just want to roll off the tongue,
right?
And are ready to go. There's something too that I wanted to get back to, Lydia, that you mentioned when we were talking about managing expectations. I think that we talk about, you know, family and caregiver managing expectations, even sometimes, you know, victims and survivors managing expectations of your healing is not dependent on whether or not someone is adjudicated for this crime. Those two things are very separate, and working on that is a really hard concept for so many, and I get it. But I think it's really important to focus on those two things separately, but also helping our team members manage their expectations. We've all had cases where we get so hot about what should be done or what should have happened or who should have said what, or why isn't this child disclosing, or why isn't, you know, we like to mom blame too. So there's always like, why isn't this mom, you know, protecting? And and it's so hard for us to manage our own expectations. And not be, you know, angry that a child or, you know, adolescent didn't perform in a certain way.
Right.
And so I think that it's easier said than done. I'll say that. But again, we have to be patient with an individual's process, because they're the ones that are going to know best about when it's okay and safe to talk about their story.
Right. Well, and two things that I just wanted to jump onto here. One is that, you know, like you say, get some training. I think that many of us think, well, I've worked with sexual assault survivors for all these years, or I've worked with children of sexual assault offenses for all these years. But it's a very different experience to work with a 5 or 6 or 8 year old who's a sexual assault survivor or victim than it is somebody who's disclosing at 30, 40, 50, 60. And
yes,
if you have only worked with children, then, you know, take the opportunity to go meet with your sexual assault programs in the community that work with adults when they disclose. Yes. And vice versa. You know, if you only work with if you're an advocacy or a program or a sexual assault program that only has had experience working with adults, go learn about how do you do, and not because you're going to become an expert then in interviewing children, but it helps you then when that moment comes that all of a sudden there's a disclosure or something that you're wondering how should I respond to this? It isn't so foreign because you have to do it differently. We do children, we respond and support kids differently than we do adults that disclose. The other thing that I think is really important, and that is that oftentimes when there is child abuse, we also know that there's domestic violence somewhere or can be in those families, and oftentimes with the non-offending caregiver or others. And so it's really important to get out of those silos and learn about how it is that we can be supportive and who our resources in the community are. So if all of a sudden something comes up and there's some sort of a disclosure about other kind of harm or violence, that we can act on that, and not in a way that's surprising, like, well, that's not my wheelhouse, right? I'm just doing this piece here. And I think we can probably do a better job with some of that cross training and support of one another to work in abuse in all areas.
Oh, yes, I agree with you. I mean, there, you know, years ago, you know, polyvictimization really kind of lit up, you know, the research and conferences and things like that. But it's so important, I agree with you, to screen for different, we use different questions. We talk to families about different things, because you're right. Usually, we are going to find, you know, multiple types of abuse occurring. And some of those, it's interesting when we were talking about, you know, being victim-centered, something that has frustrated teams in the past is, you know, a child, you know, has been physically or sexually abused, but what they really want to talk about and what they really want to spend their time, you know, discussing in the forensic interview is, you know, the emotional abuse that they went through and how hurtful that was. And of course, you're balancing this as a professional, like attending to what this child is saying. And it's very, very important. And then also knowing that, you know, proving that and corroborating that is very difficult. And so we have to kind of, you know, steer back to the other types of abuse that has also brought the child here. But we don't get to decide what is the biggest deal,
right?
For children and for victims and survivors. We don't get to know and pick for them that this is what was worse or this is the most important thing. And so that's something that has surprised me in listening to so many children and adolescent stories about the thing that stood out to them the most, or the thing that you know, was the worst or most hurtful. It's rarely the thing that I would think of after hearing their story. Absolutely. And so again, we just don't get to put our lens on someone else's story because we'll get it wrong every time.
Yeah, we absolutely will. And I have said this so many times to myself, to remind myself that we don't get to also measure the damage done to somebody who's been victimized by the nature of the offense, right?
Yeah. So
if somebody is, I've worked with sexual assault survivors who have been through the most horrible, awful hour after hour after hour of sexual assault and gotten up the next day after the sexual assault exam and gone to work. And then I've worked with some survivors who have, quote unquote, just been victimized by a very lesser offense, a touching offense, or even more of a sexual harassing offense that really, really, really struggled on that journey to healing. And so, you know, to me, that's what victim-centered is. It's not looking at what the nature of the offense is or what somebody was convicted of or even how many times it happened or what kind of abuse it was. It was how is that affecting the heart, mind, spirit, body, health of the individual who's been harmed, and that changes. So yeah, I totally agree with you. So can we talk a little bit about, there's a couple more things I just want to talk with you a little bit about. One is that whole support system, and you really mentioned several things that I would love to continue to talk about. We might be here for 8 hours. But, you know, the importance of that support network for the survivor, regardless of what age they are when they share their story or disclose, and how important it is for us to think outside the box of who may be the most obvious support person might be and why it might be important to have a couple layers there or some backup plans to that support person. Certainly it's one issue when it's a child, but also if it's an adult who's sharing their story. Can you talk a little bit about that support system and that network and the importance of kind of having that full baseball bench, as we might call it, of support?
Yes. So I have so many thoughts on this. Because, you know, in my experience, and I'm sure in yours, we have seen people fail one another when we thought they shoulda, woulda, coulda been part of that baseball team support. So there's that. We don't get to decide who's going to stand up and who's going to be supportive. We would like to hope that it might be these, you know, X, Y, Z people, but we don't get that. So I think... That's something that's very important to address early on, with families, with the child, with the teenager, and talk about what does support look like for you? How do you know you're being supported? And then really having an aside in particular with that parent and caregiver and saying, you know, here, when your child wants to process, here's, you know, some appropriate things to say to them. Here's how to show them that you're listening, that you're caring. And then what do you do with that information? How do you then process? And having a backup plan for that person, because they can't just think that they're going to absorb all of this pain and suffering and this their child's story and think, oh, they're just going to go right back about their business. And so I think you have to have like their support, their secondary support, and there's tertiary support for the supporters. So it's this big ripple effect. It sounds really crazy when you say it that way. But I think if you're not looking at support being, multi-layered and strategic, then you're really missing it from the get-go. And so there's bound to be holes. When we have children or teenagers that it's clear they're not going to have the familial support, I think it's really important to have an open and honest conversation about that early on and say, okay, so you know what? Mom, dad, stepdad, stepmom, auntie, they're not going to be your people. That's okay. Who else are we looking at? I can think of one teenager that I worked with. I was so impressed with. She drove an hour and a half every single week by herself because her support system was at our center in Pocatello. Those were, I was her counselor. She had, you know, she came. So even just seeing our front office staff, you know, was something that was a light and a support for her. Of course they weren't processing her victimization, but just, it was someone that she could count on, that was excited to see her and was welcoming for her to come in and process. And so it's going to come in all shapes and sizes, but it's so important to have a real deep dive conversation about what does that look like? Who can you turn to, whether, and who's appropriate. Right. So there's another educational piece of, your peer at school, although they're your best friend, or, you know, maybe you think they're your best friend. We've all seen that go so awry, right, and cause so much harm and, you know, other, you know, and exacerbate the trauma that they've already been through. Right. So we also have to talk about who is an appropriate support person and who is not, and educating the family on that. Yeah. So it's complicated, and can I just say too, but that doesn't mean that you don't do it.
Right, right, exactly. And can I just say, we have to do a better job of supporting you all to do this work on a more long-term basis. I think sometimes we take those folks that are doing child advocacy and we're like, well, we just need to get them from point A to point B, or to we get this case charged out or convicted or whatever. And yeah, you said it so well, you know, leaving the child advocacy center on day six of working with this victim might look very different 6 months from now when the family's all fighting, because now people have divided sides. Who's going to, you know, especially if the perpetrator is in the family. So now you've got this family that's divided, where initially all the support was in this one area, but it's changed. Or maybe it's a school that is supportive and now school is out. Maybe it's a faith-based organization and that possibly, or sporting or somewhere, that's where the abuse took place. And so if we don't support those of you that do this work in child advocacy centers to be able to have the funding and the support to continue to work with victims, we don't want to keep them in a place of victimization forever. That's not the goal. Right. But holy cow, I just heard you say so much in that few minutes that I'm thinking all of this support for these survivors could change so quickly over 6 months or a year. And then what? You know?
And then what? You know, unfortunately, Lydia, we see kids come back. You know, and we see them, they've been, you know, re-victimized in a different way or by a different person. A lot of the kids that we see that come back, it is not the same offender at all. It's a completely different person. So it is so complicated, but it's imperative that we take the time and look at, you know, getting the services in line and staying healthy ourselves. Because we're no good if we're like, here, read this pamphlet, do this, that, push this paper, case closed, maybe not. I mean, you know, but I think it's also, I mean, when I say like having complicated and difficult conversations with the family, we have to have complicated and difficult conversations with our colleagues about what's going on. How are you doing? How are you taking this home? I can't tell you how many times I have spoken with our male, primarily police detectives, and just said, you know, it's really normal to, you know, to have, you know, ruminating thoughts about, you know, this horrible case that we just worked, or not want to be intimate, you know, with your partner when you get home like that. And they were like, are you serious? Like other people have. And I'm like, yes. Yes, this shouldn't be a secret. This is impactful. We just heard the most heinous thing. You're literally sifting through some really, really tough stuff, you know, with this little human. And so if you think that that's not going to impact you or your sexuality or whatever, you're crazy. But we don't. That's an uncomfortable conversation. It's not something that we're bringing up. And, you know, and if you do have that conversation, is it because you're in trouble or you think that if you say the wrong thing, you're going to be kicked off these types of cases? I mean, we hear that too. Right. And so I think trying to get real about the realities of this work and how it can impact our day to day. And it's not something that we can always shut off and then walk in our front door. And as we were speaking earlier, right now, a lot of people don't have the luxury of shutting off their computer and taking a minute to drive home or walk home or whatever. You are home. Home in the middle of your family, and you're going, oh my gosh, I hope that no one overheard, you know, this last conversation. Because it's, you know, obviously we don't want to traumatize anyone else. So it's all complicated, but that doesn't mean that we don't still try to do better and still acknowledge that this is hard work and we have to check in on and be victim-centered for the families and the victims that we serve, but also be, you know, centered on our own health and well-being.
So
that we can stay in this. We're playing the long game here.
We really are. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because that was going to kind of be my final zinger that I didn't tell you I was going to ask you about. And that is, how do we stay healthy in this work, you know? And I've shared with you before that both my husband and I have done this work for almost 30 years. And it's hard not to absorb it. And that's the only way I can say it. And I have a really good friend, Jen Storm, who talks about being a sponge, and whether you think you're absorbing it, you're not. And, you know, it's that whole thing that even my husband and I have talked about. How many people actually have to say to their kids, have had the conversation, you know, if mommy or daddy are in the grocery store, or if we're at church, or if we're at a ball game and somebody walks up and starts talking to us and we give you this look, this is what you need to do. I mean, that's just not normal, you know, and not every grandfather who happens to pick up their child after school every day and is a caregiver is an abuser. But you do this work all the time, and it isn't even just what you do, but it's how you see the world. And it's just so incredibly important to take care of your own health. And, you know, Anne, I'm going to, now that you've started talking about this, I just wrote it down. I'm going to bring you back when we start doing our well-being podcast on this, because I think you are so important. And when you just said, I'll go talk to some law enforcement that I've worked with and bring this up. What that said to me is when we talk about MDTs or multidisciplinary teams, it's, yes, it's really about a collaborative way of being able to address sexual assault and child abuse. Yeah. But it's also a way for us to be able to support one another in this work because there's very few people that are part of this club that have raised their hand that says, I'll do this. And you are right. I think it's a scary thing to go down that road of saying my sponge is really full right now and I don't know how to empty it a little bit. And it's affecting my marriage or it's affecting my relationships. Yeah. It's affecting the way I'm parenting. It's affecting my sleep. I'm coming home instead of making a drink on Friday, I'm making one at 4:30 on a Tuesday, whatever that might be. And, you know, do you have any other tips or tools for those that are maybe working with survivors that are sharing their stories, whether it be that initial disclosure or later on, because their stories then become part of what is a chip in your brain now. If you're listening to stories all day, every day, these are tough stories. So how do you do that? How do you personally bring out your sponge?
Well, I think that the one tip or trick that I think is important is a lot of times we've worked a case or we've, you know, been part of a situation that is so awful and you just want to tell your colleague about it or you want to tell, you know, your MDT partner about it. And I would caution you to think about what is in this scenario, the situation that is bothering you so much? Because rarely is it about the XYZ heinous thing that happened to this child that does not need to necessarily be shared with your, you know, MDT partner or your colleague that you're processing. That's not it. It's the fact that you have an 8-year-old also, or you just can't understand how a human could hurt another human this way. And it's, you know, it hurts your heart or whatever it is. Because I think sometimes we just get so overloaded that you kind of verbally vomit, you know, some really awful pieces to what you've just been through that day or observed or heard or whatever. And although it kind of feels good to do in the moment, it's really, you know, traumatizing it. We can use, you know, what secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, you name whatever verbiage you want to give to it. But I would just be very cautious that we're not sharing those pieces that truly don't matter. Of course they matter to what happened to that child. But when you're, as far as wringing out your sponge, that's not the part that matters. The part that matters is how it's resonating with you, how it's impacting you. And then to switch gears, I would say we have to acknowledge that the way that we parent is different. The way that we think about cell phones and our kids, the way that we view sleepovers, the way that we view family reunions, or whatever the case is. And it's, if you're not real about how your worldview has shifted, that's a problem. We have to at least acknowledge it to then keep it in check. And so I joke with my husband all the time. I'm like, okay, well, this is where I'm coming at from, you know, this is where I'm coming from. This is the angle that I'm seeing this. Is that like, where are you on this meter of, you know, am I just, you know, out of line, out of touch, paranoid, whatever, and finding kind of a common medium. And it's really most of the time we're eye to eye, but it's, we still have to keep that in check. And I don't think we can pretend that this job hasn't changed us. It has. Those are kind of two things. I mean, you have to acknowledge the ways that it's changed you for better or for worse. There's so many wonderful ways that this job has changed my life and the work that we do. But there's also things that I think about that are not normal. They're not normal. My friends don't work in this field, they would never think that. My husband would never think that. And I said to him the other day, I wish I could remember what it was, But I said, you know, when I hear this, this is the first thing that goes through my mind.
Yeah.
And he goes, wow, that's weird. And yep. I said, yeah, it is. But it just, it is. But I mean, I feel like if I didn't even acknowledge it and at least, you know, kind of humor myself, it could go to a darker place than it needed to.
Right.
Because right. It does change. And that's why we need one another to have open and honest dialogues about it, not sharing gory details for the sake of sharing gory details, but how that impacts us. Because back to what we were saying earlier about, you know, about victims and survivors sharing their story. When we all want to be normal. So when I told our detectives that it's normal to, you know, not want to be intimate or, you know, have their wife, you know, or partner do something sexual that was just described to us by a child that day, that's okay. That's normal. They were so relieved. And it's like, yeah, because we all just want to be normal. We want to know that what we're thinking or feeling isn't crazy. So I think on both ends of that spectrum, victim, survivor, and then, you know, everyone that works in this field, it's important to share our experiences and how it impacts us on a human level, because we don't want to be alone. No one wants to be alone.
Right, right. And I think, too, we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to our families. We also owe it to the survivors that are trusting us with their stories to be in a place where we're healthy enough to be able to support them without it being that final straw that broke the camel's back, or without us going to that place that says, I can't even be here to support you because I've got so much in my brain right now. You know, like you said, I've got the 8-year-old or whatever that might be. And that's another thing too, that I think we have to be able to do, is if there's a case that we're working on that is just too close to home, it's important for us to have processes in our workplace and to be vulnerable enough to say, this one's not going to work for me. You know, can somebody else take this case? And you don't have to get into why, but to have those situations or that plan in place in your organization first, so that people don't feel odd or strange or weak coming to ask to do that, I think is so important, which kind of leads me to my final question here, which is one of my favorites. You know, what suggestions do you have or recommendations do you have as we move forward? And I kind of like to call them calls to action. So if we were to do a better job of as a whole, whether it be communities, families, advocacy, criminal justice, faith organizations, what is the one thing that you think that we could do to create a better, safer space for, first of all, children to disclose and share their stories and what they look like then, but also for survivors sometimes many years later who want to do that? Is there something that we could all do that would begin to move us from point A to point B to make that a safer, more healing experience, do you think, for victims?
Yeah. And I think, you know, the easiest and the most basic, but most difficult thing to do, is when someone is starting to tell their story, try to quiet your own mind, your own judgment, your own, you know, paradigms and kind of boxes of, oh, I've heard this before, or, oh, that sounds like this, or that's impossible. Or, you know, all the things that start to just clutter through because you're trying to sift out what's what and how could this be, or how could it make sense from your point of view, because that's the only way that we can, what we're operating off of, right? We're thinking about our own life experiences, our own point of view, and how does this story kind of work or not work, or does it sound accurate or not accurate or made up or imagined? And I just think that's where we get so lost. We're not listening.
Yeah.
We're not hearing.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, definitely easier said than done, but trying to be very quiet in your body and in your mind and just be present to hear what this person has to say. And withholding your judgment about that. While, you know, I'm sure you might have a job to do later. Listen, I'm not taking that away from anybody. There's going to be steps and processes and protocols and procedures, etc. But in that moment, being so careful to just hear what they're saying, truly hear and listen and not interrupt, or add your own commentary. I've seen so many kids and teenagers stop talking and shut down because they were interrupted or there was a really insensitive question asked, which they, you know, thought was insensitive or they felt like was a non-believing question or something like that, but that it interrupted this person's narrative. And once it's interrupted, it changes. It's, oh, don't say that again, or oh, that didn't go over well, or they didn't believe this part, or it changes, it shifts. Yeah. And so like I said, it's easier said than done, but when someone is trusting you in that space, make the time. Put your cell phone away, turn your computer off, because sometimes it happens and you're not expecting it. Other times, you know, you're all seated in a forensic interview, you know what's going down. But if it happens out of the blue, and even in the forensic interview, you still have to quiet your mind. But when that's happening, that's what I would say to do. I mean, that is where we can reduce so much trauma that happens and re-victimization that happens when people are just trying to tell their story.
Right.
So it's an exercise to try.
It is. And it's practice, right? It's always practice. I think that sometimes it's actually harder for some of us that have done this for decades to do that. Cause you're right. We have heard lots of stories where I think when you just start doing this work, you're so eager to learn. We need to take that same calm, quiet mind 25 years into this as we might on year one. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. So is there anything else that you want to leave our listeners with? This has been very rich, and I'm guessing this will be two podcasts, which is fantastic. And I'm sure we're going to be having you again, since I took several notes here on other issues that I think and topics that would be great to have you join us with. But is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners as we go to sign off on this one?
Oh, gosh. You know, I know we use the word story and people's story a lot. And I want to just be clear that I'm not minimizing. When I say story, I'm using it interchangeably with experience. And so I just wanted to make that note that when we've been saying, you know, this person's story, that's not alluding to any sort of make-believe or made-up situation, but really speaking about their experience. And and if we think about it in those terms of this was someone's lived experience, I feel like it has a little bit of a different flavor and calls attention to it more so that we can really truly lean in and listen and be quiet and hear about their lived experience, because we weren't there. We don't know what happened. Yeah. And so they're the only ones that can inform us on what happened, and also moving forward, what could be helpful for them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And continuing to be aware that that is dynamic and it is not a static process for them. Well, I cannot tell you what a gift it has been to share this time with you. I always love spending some time with you, and this pandemic that we've been in has not allowed us to be together as much, but this has been, I learn so much from you every time I have the opportunity to spend some time talking with you, and it's just such such a gift. So thank you so much. So that is all for this episode.
You have been listening to Stronger, Safer, the podcast series of Building Hope Today, Voices of Victims. Remember, our goal is to give voice to victims and survivors and those that work tirelessly to support victims and survivors. Our goal is also to support those that work every single day to stop and prevent victimization and child abuse. Your voice matters, and our podcast must include you. If you have a question about something that you heard today, or an idea for a future episode, or if you have an idea for a guest that you'd like to suggest, or would like to be a guest yourself, please contact us at info@buildinghopetoday.org. We would love to hear from you. Remember, no matter who you are, survivor, justice system professional, adult advocate, child advocate, mental health provider, teacher, parent, or community member, you make a difference. You matter. And as Edward Hale once said, I am only one, but still I am one. I cannot do everything, but I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something I can do. You make a difference, even if it's for just one person.